Welcome to the podcast of the European Society of Anesthesiology and Intensive Care. I'm your host, Peter Kranke, from the University of Würzburg. I'm professor of anesthesia at the University of Würzburg Department of Anesthesiology. And today we will be speaking about how guidelines are created. And there we have invited Dr. Carolina Romero. She's chairperson of the SAIC Guideline Committee. Welcome.
Thank you, Peter. Happy to be here.
Good to talk to you today. Carolina, you have some experiences in guideline creation. Can you comment on which is the first step when you guys decide it's time to start with a new guideline, drafting a new guideline?
Okay, so that's a really good question, Peter, and I hope that during this podcast, you also can give us your point of view, since you're also the current past chairperson of the guidelines committee, so you have a lot of knowledge also in developing guidelines. So from my perspective, the first step to decide to create and develop a new guideline is to find a relevant question, a relevant clinical question that we need to address in order to give clinicians and patients information, evidence-based information on what is the best approach or the best treatment regarding a specific condition of considering some specific diseases or interventions. So my main idea when I decide if we have to pursue the creation of a clinical guideline is what is the relevance of this question? Do you agree on this, Peter?
Yeah, of course. So you start with an actual demand, with a critical question, with an important outcome, and maybe also on topics where there is no guidance so far.
Yes, yes, completely. Okay. Because if there is already a clinical guideline that was made last year, probably it's not relevant that we update a guideline that is already created. Yeah, I agree with that.
And following that first step, you decide we need a new guidance on, let's say, neuromuscular blockade in adult patients, how the roadmap looks like. Could you break down the entire life cycle of guideline development a little bit for us? I mentioned there's quite a bit involvement from start to finish, and what are the key milestones you hit along the way?
Okay, so I will answer in this question, like summarizing all the clinical steps or all the steps that we have to that we have to walk while we do our guidelines. Though the process might be a little bit more complex depending on a specific guideline. But the first thing, as I said, is to decide on a relevant clinical question that we want to answer. Then the second question is to find a diverse group of authors that have a contrasted experience on that topic. Also, the panel should be a diverse panel with many backgrounds from many countries, different types of expertise, and also to find or appoint a person that will be leading the author group. So when we have the author group, we have to ask which questions we want to answer. And this could be the second step, let's say, in the process of developing a guideline, that is to put the questions in a PICO format that stands for P for patients, I for intervention, C for comparator, and O for outcomes. That is in the majority of cases. So here we try to draft what are the questions that we want to answer with our literature search. So after we have the clinical question, second step, we decide on the panel. Third step, we develop the PICOs, the clinical questions that we want to answer. Then we have to contact a literature search specialist that will design a specific and custom-made search for receiving all articles that are relevant for this topic. Also, this process takes some time since we have to do some modifications to verify that all meaningful terms are included and also key articles are included within this search. And then the next step will be to screen all these articles. We do usually three stages while screening. First, we screen for titles, second for abstracts, and third for author for the full text. And also we have some disagreements if we decide to include or exclude these articles, then a third review will come into the play. And after this, we have to, next step would be to extract the data. So here from the relevant articles that we found to create this guideline, we have to extract the data. And when possible, we will aim to conduct a systematic review to see in an object matter what is the importance and the what is the best approach in that case. And when it's not possible, we just pull the evidence. And with this data, we try to make, we will produce a grading of this recommendation based in one side on our subjective opinion on what's the trade-off between the benefits and the burden of a specific intervention, and also based of the quality of the evidence that is backing this recommendation. So, I mean, Peter, I know that I spoke and just gave a long speech, because at the end is many steps that we will need to take into account. But just to say in one sentence which are the main stages or milestone as you define is, first, ask the question. Second, look for a panel that is diverse and has expertise in that topic. Third, to define and describe the pillars that you want to address in the guideline. Fourth could be to conduct a literature search. Five, to screen the articles. Six, to extract the data. And then seven, to draft the recommendations and the rationale and try to make a balanced decision based on the evidence and based on personal opinions. Did I miss something?
There are many steps involved.
Yeah, many steps.
And of course, I realized that quality plays an important role in developing guidelines. Can you tell the readers or the viewers of this podcast a little bit, how long does it usually take from drawing a board to seeing the guideline actually published in the European Journal of Anesthesiology?
That's also a really, really good question. And I would say, I would like to answer that it would depend on the guideline. So smallest guidelines with few PICOs, they can take maybe between 12 and 18 months to publish. Because obviously, I didn't mention all the steps like doing the risk of bias of each study, then the open process of peer review that we have to undergo. So the smallest guideline, let's say 1.5 years, and we have some huge guidelines that we are trying to accommodate in the smallest budget, so they are more digestible. They can take up to 3 years. So yeah, it's really a long, long time of many people working in guidelines.
So it actually depends on the amount of questions you want to answer, also the amount of time people are ready to spend to guideline development. I think we need to remind ourselves that people are usually busy clinicians who do this in their spare time. And focusing a little bit on the people behind guideline development, usually there is mention of a methodologist. Could you explain us why a methodologist plays such an important role in shaping these guidelines?
So as we've been discussing, guidelines are complicated itself in the meaning that you have many steps to follow. So guidelines are basically another type of study. For example, if they were a randomized controlled trial, and obviously you need a person who has the expertise on how to do a guidelines. It's not that I think that in some years or maybe some decades ago, guidelines were made like some people sitting in the table, like it was all boys sitting at the table methodology. So people just gathered together, discussed things, and yeah, in that way, they decide what the others should do based just on their opinion. So still, I think there are some people that think that guidelines is something that you can do out of the blue without not support, and yeah, mostly that's it. But now we know if we want to produce high quality guidelines that are not based in personal opinion, that can be influenced also by risk of bias. If we don't want to do what is medical reverse, that is when we apply one treatment and then from some years from now we discover that it was harmful for the patient. So we have to follow strict methodologies to produce guidelines that are the less propensity to be biased. Although everything that we do is biased, obviously, but that's the role of the methodologies to assure the quality and to assure that there are not opinion of a specific person that is maybe more important or famous or whatever,
yeah,
and will influence the panel.
Yeah, because some of the content experts actually have no specific knowledge in guideline development and the methodology behind it. So let's take a closer look at the different formats for those of us trying to navigate in guidelines, consensus statements. Could you clarify the differences between, let's say, clinical practice guidelines or guidelines, consensus documents, expert opinion statement? What's different between these formats?
Okay, so this question is also a really good question, and is also relation with the previous question, and I think already mentioned some hints on what's the difference. And let's say that imagine that we don't have randomized clinical trials, for example, during COVID times. We needed time to produce evidence. We needed time to produce and see the results from randomized clinical trials. So in that time, we don't have evidence. So when we don't have evidence, we don't have primary studies, we need to rely on expert opinions or consensus documents. That is, as if you remember, if the pyramid of the quality of the evidence is the lower part, is the lowest part of the pyramid, is the one, the information that is has more bias itself. So consensus documents or expert opinions are only valid when you don't have any other evidence. Imagine also that we have a new drug or whatever, and we don't have randomized clinical trials supporting this drug, we will need to rely on the opinion on the experts. And when we have more evidence, like cohort studies, prospective studies, observational studies, and also when we have randomized clinical trial, we should aim at producing a clinical practice guideline that have all these steps that I've tried to break it down, maybe with not much success, but I tried to do it. And this is a topic that would lead us for many hours discussion, but just to make it short, when we have the evidence, we have to produce a clinical practice guideline following all these steps, although it's more complicated, but is more reliable. And when we don't have evidence, then we will take a clinical practice statement that is the expert opinion, but that's it.
That's a good point, yeah. And sometimes really fascinating that for important clinical questions, we actually don't have any good and solid evidence. I remember the current situation in the epidural failure guideline, where we are faced with the fact that there's virtually no real good evidence there to answer our clinical questions or PICOs. And yes, there are many scientific societies out there sometimes focusing on the same topic. Let's say ASA, ESAIC, the national societies. And it's sometimes fascinating but yet confusing when guidelines differ on recommendations. This was not the case, for instance, in neuromuscular guideline, where ASA and SI virtually in the same time produced their guidelines and came to the same conclusion. But you may remember the ASC recommendation on the use of troponins as cardiac markers in the palliative setting. They advised to use troponins more frequently, while ESIC assumes a more conservative approach. So what's behind these contradictions? Can you explain to our viewers, readers, how these contradictions come into place? Why can this happen?
That's, Peter, a really tough question. And I would like to, for me, it's even difficult sometimes to understand all the jargon. And I think even for those that work mainly in evidence medicine and systematic review, guidance group, etc., internationally, they also struggle because the taxonomy has more than 500 terms to refer to sometimes topics that are the same. But I would say that first thing, in this particular case, the ESC guidelines, they use a different methodology. There are not only one methodology for doing or developing a guideline, there are many methodologies. So unfortunately, we don't have any way of comparing which methodology is better than the other. So that's the first thing, and why you can get maybe different recommendation. And the other thing is the scope. I think in the first case, the European Society of Cardiology, they have a broader scope. And in our case, we have a really narrow scope where we focus only on 2-3 questions. So we could look at a huge detail and in very extent what was the outcome and what was happening. And since we were very focused in this, in assessing the relevance and the importance of preventing diseases, let's say, with the troponins, we could finally decide and recommend not to do it extensively. Even the cardiologists in Japan, they also did a guideline, and they share the same conclusions as we do. So it all matters on how you formulate the questions and how in depth you look at the question.
For our readers, are there any signs of credibility, any systems they can use to assess the validity of guideline recommendations?
So I think that the key word here, and I also think that you will agree with me, is being transparent on what you do. So when you can show what are the studies that you use to back your recommendation, and you saw them clearly, and you present the data, even for example with a systematic review, and you decide why you included this study or why you didn't include the other study that could affect the final outcome, you have to be very transparent. And then there are some other groups like the GRADE Network Working Group. They have like a check. They have decided that you should check that there is a checklist with all reporting items similar to Equator Network to reporting guidelines. So I would say first, transparency. And second, that unfortunately, you have to navigate and look in detail what are all the steps that the guideline group did in order to create that guideline. And surely to define a methodology as among the authors to assure a high quality.
And coming a little bit back to the ESIC members, if some members feel there is a gap in knowledge or a gap in guideline, in guidance, or a topic we have overlooked in the past, how can they react? What is the best course of action? Can they apply for a guideline? Can they suggest topics? To whom should they ask or direct the request?
So I think that, so as we say, guidelines are for clinicians, but also for patients, policymakers. So in case we have any member that is that spot a gap in the clinical context regarding the guidance, they can send an email stating the request and the necessity that they think that we in which area we think that they think that we should to produce a guideline. And in that case, they should address this email to the guidelines committee. That is the email that is guidelines at saic.org. And they can ask, for example, this, how should I start the process? And in this process, eventually they will give an application form with some details. What is the gap in research? What is the experience that you have? You have already people in mind to collaborate. And after this, if we see that we have enough room to give support and this and that is also aligns with the priorities at SAIC, we will support this group to create this guideline.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Slowly coming to an end. Could you let us in on a standout moment or breakthrough that it was a direct result of the guidelines coming to life? Or are you especially proud of one guideline project where you think that was an ideal situation you experienced during guideline development?
Well, I think it's difficult. It's really difficult to choose only one guideline. I believe there are many, many good guidelines that we have at SAIC, and the last day, the last years, we really produce really high quality guidelines with many efforts from authors and also SAIC staff. But one of the things that I'm most proud of is that now also at the guidelines committee, and thank you to the work of my predecessor, like Aras Asfari, and also like you, Peter Kranke. So now we are in a perfect moment to keep growing, and we are also planning to increase the quality of our guidelines and also to give more support to authors developing guidelines.
Right.
And this in combining this also with a new idea for creating guidelines based on implementation and including implementation of guidelines, this is going to be my main focus for the next year. So a lot of work to do, but I'm really looking forward to it.
So thank you, Carolina. You've already answered the last question about the exciting changes you expect to come or innovations. You've spoken about improving methodology and being even more tight in terms of methodology. Thanks, Carolina. You've already expressed the thank for the guideline team at SAIC. Also, thank you from my side. Thank you for these valuable first-hand insights into the world of guidelines and guideline development. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode. And the SAIC releases monthly podcasts on the SAIC website and various streaming platforms, and we hope you will join us for the next one.